This is URN.
Hello and welcome to Nerd of Mouth, the weekly show where we talk about everything nerdy. You're joined by me, Philippa, this week. I use she, her pronouns. My nerdy thing this week is I read A Discovery of Witches by Deborah Harkness, which is all about witches, but also vampires and demons. And it's about this lady who discovers a manuscript that's been lost and it awakens some magical power. And then she has to try and run away from everyone else who wants to read it. And I'm joined by...
Hello, my name is Jamie. My pronouns are he and him, and the only thing I've been doing this week is running some calculations on time travel, and I think I've definitively proven that time travel can't possibly exist until the end of the universe itself.
So it's just the two of us this week, and this week we thought we would have a little talk about tropes that are common, some which are good, some which are annoying, in various forms of nerd culture. So, Jamie, what do you sort of class as a trope?
Well, a trope, in my understanding, sort of functions almost like if memes were plot devices, so to speak. It's sort of it's something that's replicable, it's something that happens in pop culture more than you would normally expect in a normal distribution, in a way.
It turns up over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Sometimes used well, sometimes not.
Yeah, some things people notice and think, you know, I will either do this because that's what the genre demands, or I have noticed this thing and I'll do a slight twist on it.
So do you have any tropes that you particularly like seeing?
There's lots of tropes that I quite like seeing. One of my favourites is one that happens quite a lot in Doctor Who, where there's sort of a false dichotomy is presented. Someone says, you have to do this bad thing, or you have to do this bad thing. And hero finds a way to actually put out a third thing, which is quite nice.
Oh, yes, the twist. I do like a twist.
Yeah, I suppose it's not necessarily, you know, a trope so much as it is, you know, it's a plot device, and it's one that's easily replicable, really. It's a matter of sort of always finding a better way, really, and I think that's... something, especially fiction, should strive for. I don't really like the idea of, in fiction, and I suppose it does happen in real life, the idea that to do good you have to do worse things and worse things and worse things over time.
Or like it often comes out as for the greater good. So obviously, Grindelwald and Dumbledore, he has to do bad because it's for the greater good. But then, but actually, maybe we can do good for the greater good.
It's always... presented as sort of so many avenues get systematically shut off for this moment of, in a way, it has to be quite forced drama sometimes for that sort of thing, and it can devolve into a sort of you can't, if you do this, you will yourself become a monster. And one of the tropes I particularly hate is the hero is about, has the villain on the ropes, and thinks, aha, I can kill you, but if I kill you, I will be as bad as you.
Very Batman, sort of.
I mean, and I can absolutely see there are many, many justifications for a hero not to kill a villain. I just don't like the, if I kill you, I have to become as bad as you thing.
At what point is it okay to get rid of the Joker?
Yeah.
Both in the film and in real life.
This is a really petty point and a really niche point, but the one that stuck in my mind the most is many years ago, I was watching an episode of MI High, which is a CBBC show sort of coasting on the success of, I think, Alex Rider and Harry Potter and all of those.
They were spies in school,
But they were in a school, and their spy master was Danny John Jules, who's the cat from Red Dwarf. At one point, they are working with an evil villain called... I forget his name. I know his rabbit's called General Flopsy. He's sort of a James Bond-style villain, sort of Blofeld, except instead of a cat, he has a rabbit. And they have to work with him to overcome a world-ending threat. And sort of they promise to work together and not to turn him in. And then at the end, once the evil's defeated, he says, aha, I'm going back to my villainous ways now.
Of course. And does the old switcheroo.
Yes. And not so much in a sort of, I'm actually going to do some villainy now, but I'm going to go back to my base and plan to do villainy later. And the people at MI High say, actually, he's in quite a vulnerable position here. We could, at this point, send him to jail. But one of the MI High people says, no, actually, we can't do that, because we promised we wouldn't to him for the sake of this alliance. And if we lie to him, we're as bad as him. And no, that's...
He's already broken the promise, MI High, honestly.
Yeah, it's... Yeah,
I think with that, also, one of the tropes that kind of... I don't mind it in particularly, like, young adult fiction or, like, kids' shows, but particularly for, you know, stuff that's geared for adults, is seeing the... you know, the evil dark villain who is just evil because he or she is evil, and they have no real reason why they're evil, or it's just a really silly reason why they're evil. I much prefer if a villain actually has a good reason, because then they're more scary because they actually have, like, backing to why they're doing it. So, for example, Cersei, I think, in Game of Thrones is such a good villain because she actually, what she, you know, she's doing it for her family and she's doing it for a good reason. Yeah. Whereas, you know, sometimes you kind of see, like, for example, Voldemort, like, what is his real reason besides just, like, I'm just going to be so terrible that everyone must hate me?
I think you raise a very good point there, and I think, I don't know, this is something I have sort of a lot of thoughts about. I think it's always good to have villains with motivations and sympathetic motivations, just because that's true for all characters, really. You want to know what they want, what they're like as a person, what their weaknesses are. But I think there's something going on with villains, sort of in a way, where we've almost bought too much into the villains have to have sympathetic motivations, to the point where often the villains' motivations are more sympathetic than the heroes. And we end up with what I call status quo superheroes, where effectively the villain says, I am going to change society for the better, but through bad means, in a way. So you've got your Killmongers from Black Panther, you've got your Magnetos from X-Men.
Or Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog is quite a good epitome of that as well, I think.
Exactly. So you end up with these people who think, I'm going to change the world for the better, but that option involves killing people. Mm-hmm. And often the killing people is sort of something they do, not related to their villainy, but they just kill a person to prove that they are...
To prove they're evil,
And this happens in... I don't know if you watch Jenny Nicholson.
No.
But she does a fantastic video on sort of the films of Brad Bird. Mm. So The Incredibles 2, Ratatouille, The Iron Giant. And she sort of posits the idea that The Incredibles is almost built on, you know, not quite eugenics, but sort of the idea that superheroes are inherently better than people who are not heroes. So, for example, Syndrome is a good character. We know his motivations and everything. We know he wants to make everyone super for the sake of profit because he has been spurned by a superhero. But ultimately, you know, he is created by Mr. Incredible's actions, and Mr. Incredible doesn't really atone for them.
No,
in a way. He
never really says sorry.
Yeah. Syndrome's motivation is largely, I will make everyone super because I don't like that these people sort of are lifted above each other in society.
Yeah.
And yet, Mr. Incredible's main thing is, no, that's bad because you'll kill people by doing that. And it's sort of if he can find a way of doing it that doesn't kill people, it's fine and noble and everything. And we end up with a sort of cinema that sort of prioritises characters that want to maintain the status quo rather than improve society. Yeah. Where I think there's a James Bond film coming out, and there's been a little bit of a flutter around it because Rami Malek's playing the villain, and the main thing that's come out about it is that he's quite an eco-friendly villain. So he's, and I suspect it's going to be slightly more than that because he's playing a billionaire, and it's just sort of a billionaire played up to sort of a stereotype. So you've got an office with, I think they say he's got like an algae farm that generates a lot of power. But, you know, he's going to be the villain in this. And it's a way of saying, in a way, the people that are changing the world are often cast in villainous roles, where the people who are sort of defending the natural order or the status quo are the heroes who have to get rid of them, in a way.
Although that's actually one of the reasons I quite like The Incredibles, is I think they do challenge a lot of the sort of traditional tropes to do with that. So like in Incredibles 2, actually makes me think of another trope that's quite common in sort of fantasy, sci-fi, type things, which is the orphan. So, you know, I'm either a hero or a villain, and I have basically not much backstory apart from it's a tragic one. And now I have no basically familial connections, which makes it much easier to sort of isolate that character. You know, I mean, Harry Potter is obviously a quintessential example, like, but happens quite a lot in particularly kids' books, I think, because it's easy to just not write the parents in.
Yeah, it's I think it's called, I've heard it called Disney Mum Syndrome.
Yeah, exactly.
Where effectively most Disney heroines will maybe have a dad, but probably not a mum, because A, it's easier to have a cast of fewer characters. B, You get a little bit of tragedy, so you're instantly sympathetic to the character. And three, quite often in media, the mum is sort of a restraining influence on them. So without that presence, they are often more free to do things.
Yeah. Well, one it makes me think of is the Cherub series, which was...
Robert Muchamore.
So if anyone doesn't know, it's basically you become a child spy and you're getting recruited in, like MI High.
It's MI High, but with rude words
with
and
rude
occasional
words.
Sex references.
Yes. So slightly more grown up, but in that, it's like you can't become part of Cherub if you have parents, partly because your parents would stop you from becoming a child spy, because in real life, it's not a good idea to be a child spy, and it's very dangerous. So, I mean, obviously, there's an air... Some of these tropes obviously are also part of, like, suspending disbelief in things, but it does sometimes, when they're so repetitive, is when they become tropes, and it can become a bit of a problem because suddenly you're spotting them instead of staying immersed in the story, I find.
Yes, and you're right, actually. I think most spies are orphans, I think.
Yeah.
Alex Rider is an orphan. What's his name? James Bond's an orphan.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see why we'd hear about Tom Cruise's character in Mission Impossible's parents, but as far as
I mean,
we know,
as an. Often in that it's a usually start as a child and they've lost their parents, as opposed to, you know, once you become an adult, it's just you've lost your parents, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's still sad for them, but it's a slightly different story background to being cast as the orphan. So
yeah, but I think especially in spy fiction, it sort of puts forward this idea that actually to do this job, you have to be quite detached, and I think that's a thing that's maybe quite bad for orphans in real life to think.
Yeah.
I mean, they're probably more represented in the media than they are necessarily in real life, but also at the same time it's...
But they're given a certain view, because, like, orphans often appear in horror films as well.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, this child has been sent to an orphanage and it's so bad, but, you know, actually, hopefully in real life you're not going to turn into a horror character just because, you know, you don't have a mum or you don't have a dad.
Yes.
Speaking of tropes that can be damaging, I think there are quite a few out there that, you know, lots of people push back against. So one that I've heard talked about a lot is, like, just tropes of women, particularly in video games, but in media a lot tends to happen. So, for example, Anita Sarkeesian, a little while back, did her whole series on tropes of women in video games, and she talked about, for example, the damsel in distress. So the princess in the tower, Mario was coming to save Peach. Peach doesn't get to... save herself. which did cause a lot of backlash for Anita Sarkeesian with Gamergate.
But I
think she had some good points, which is that, you know, sometimes when we reinforce the same thing over and over again, it just becomes repetitive and it gets it harder to play the game in a new way.
Yes, I think there's definitely a shortage in a way of archetypes for women. I think sort of this is a quite a weird thing, because I think most of the people that are interested in getting into, say, performing arts, for example, are women, so you'd expect there to be almost four times as many actresses as there are actors. But I suspect the number of people that are writing and producing things are all male, and therefore those ideas are put forward more, and so therefore actors are boosted above actresses because there are more calls for male roles.
Yeah.
And because of that, you get more sort of character archetypes generated.
I'm interested in also... So for me, growing up, I never was particularly bothered if the character was male. It didn't stop me from playing a game or watching a film. Did you ever think, like, oh, that character's too much, I don't really want to see that because that's a girl's thing or whatever? Or did you have people in your life telling you that?
I think there's definitely a thing where male is viewed as a default, whereas female is sort of viewed as a particular thing. So you think, you know, I can be Mario, but I can't be Peach, for example. And I, you know, definitely when I was younger, I had a huge aversion to playing female characters. I have an embarrassing memory where I absolutely refused to act out a female character in charades, which is, thankfully, I'm past that now. And in one D&D campaign I'm playing a female character, but it's definitely something in a way. I think it
sets you up for not wanting to do it later, which is a shame. Whereas So I think the thing I'm trying to say is, obviously, like, these tropes are not just damaging for women playing games, but it can be quite damaging for men playing games as well.
Oh, absolutely.
It means you don't get to try this whole other side of it, which can be a shame.
One thing of note, there's a Tumblr post from a while ago saying that the idea of an everyman sort of is inherently focused on male in a way. But if you want someone that truly represents, if you want a true everyman, you'd want someone who is sort of alternate between male and female and is probably Chinese and is most likely called Muhammad Lee in terms of just pure statistical.
If you're going to have the average, they'd probably have some strange averages going on.
And yet, almost universally, the sort of the average male is portrayed as a slightly inept white man.
Yeah, who may
That's
or may
not,
not
say that white men aren't inept, but still.
But they're certainly portrayed that way a lot of the time. Or they're portrayed as buff and manly, and I will, you know, chop down this dragon for you, princess. Like, no, I want to chop down the dragon myself. Hmm. The other end of it also is then you don't tend to get quite so many skimpy bikinis on men when you then age up into the next sort of round of games. Hmm. Whereas there seem to be a large amount of very tiny armour designs going on for female characters in later games.
Yes, this is something that comes up in superheroes quite a lot, is that the sort of your classic Superman and Batman archetypes, when they were designed to sort of represent the sort of the Renaissance human ideal. Mm. So there's an awful lot of musculature and sort of Statue of David sort of thing. So it's you can sort of see all of the muscles. And, you know, the female superheroes didn't come along for a while after that. I think, I don't know if Wonder Woman was the first, but she was certainly the most popular of the early ones. Whereas...
Yeah, don't test my knowledge, I'm not sure.
No, but even then, you know, men got to wear Lycra over everything, whereas women sort of had to live up to the same ideals, but also doing it while wearing even less.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's maybe something about how it was sort of founded, because I know in the 60s, sort of the idea of the miniskirt was viewed as liberating, whereas it isn't so much now.
Yeah.
Just because it was new and it was sort of against the sort of patriarchal idea of the conservative woman. But it's one of those things that sort of hung around only because it's there. It's sort of become a new restrictive tradition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, every cliche started out as a new saying, and every trope presumably started out as a new idea and has now become a little bit dated.
Definitely.
I like now we're seeing more, I think we're seeing more push for diverse characters, so more women but also more people of color, a greater range of like sexualities being shown as well, but then there's also a lot of backlash against that, unfortunately. So
it's like how you know, it's taken this long for Marvel to do a series about, say, She-Hulk or Ms. Marvel, and yet Jeremy Renner is able to, I think, strangle or sort of mime strangling his wife, and yet he's still not even going to jail. He's still getting the TV show at
exactly,
the moment.
Yeah. Or when it does happen, I really liked it's Marvel Jessica Jones.
Jessica Jones, okay,
I quite liked that series. I didn't watch all of it, but I quite enjoyed it because it is much more about her story. It's not saying, okay, we need to cater to this audience, let's just plonk something in. It's going, let's actually have a series about a person and, you know, have a fully fleshed character that happens to be a woman and has these powers. I like that a lot more. I didn't really like Ghostbusters, the new one, because it did feel like pandering, and so I think it would have been nicer to have a sequel that actually had them talking about their own story as opposed to just actually mimicking the old film.
Yes, this is, I think maybe legacy characters might be something for another week, but
we could talk about this.
There's quite often a thing for when sort of franchises are set up and maybe they're not doing so well, movie studios want to reinvigorate it by sort of aiming for a new audience. So maybe they change it to female characters, for example, and I know this happens in comics a bit every so often, so you get Sam Wilson as Captain America or Jane Foster as Thor to try and reinvigorate things. And I think Jane Foster as Thor has definitely worked very well to this end. It's now sort of getting a film. But also at the same time, it is inherently putting sort of a lesser-known character inside the mantle of a well-known character that's been there for sort of 70 years.
Yeah.
And often when you say, oh, well, this character does in and they do it much better than that other character, it's sort of, you know, I think it's a good thing, but I've certainly seen comment sections on websites that very much think this is an attack on a male character, or think that it's some sort of oppressive regime meant to kick men out of comics or something, which it clearly isn't.
No,
because
just
these things are still routinely written by white men. But
yeah, it's just trying to bring some other people into comics who might enjoy it, or other people into games.
And the idea of pandering is just effectively, you know, yes, it's pandering, but all comics are pandering. They're just pandering to different people now.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, they are still a product, aren't they? So. Thinking about coming back to tropes, this also makes me think a little bit about, this is maybe a weird segue, but one of the things I was thinking about is with sci-fi, you often get, when you have aliens, they tend to look very humanoid a lot of the time, and if they don't, it's a sort of a change from the norm. So one book I read recently was A Long Way to a Small Angry Planet by Becky Chambers.
Oh, I've been meaning to read that. Is it good?
Would definitely recommend it. Absolutely brilliant. Literally read it in a weekend. It was so good.
I've heard it's sort of... And this is the thing, I find a lot of things are just sort of vaguely described as Douglas Adamsy when they're a little bit weird.
I wouldn't say it's too Douglas Adams. I'd say it's cool. Maybe similar to like Firefly. Sort of, it's sort of slice of life, but in space.
Yeah.
But the bit that I quite enjoyed about it was that the aliens in that are not humanoid. So you have a character who is a human who is made out into space, but it's set in sort of the future where you've got a lot of different alien species who've come from different planets and are now working together. So you have, for example, the Andrisk are these lizard people, but they don't really look like humans. They look like lizards. And then there's this guy called Dr. Chef, who they describe it, he looks like a cross between an otter and like a walrus, sort of. So it's really going against like looking exactly like humans. And I think it adds a lot of depth to it because it does feel more like a believable world, whereas if every single alien you meet... just looks like a human but with blue skin, it starts feeling a bit repetitive.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's a book called, I think it's called Space Opera by Catherine Valenti, which is effectively Eurovision but in space. And they sort of do this to avoid what they call the sentience wars, which is effectively every form of life in the universe wanting to declare war on every other sentient form of life in the universe because they don't fit their definition of sentient, because they don't look the same way or they don't breathe the same things, or they don't function thoughts in the same way. So I think that's definitely something, because, you know, if we encounter alien life, the odds of it being bipedal and, you know, carbon-based and thinking like us are phenomenally small. Where do these ideas of aliens come from? Most likely, the most popular idea of an alien is a little green man that's been popularised since Area 51.
Oh, yeah. That little grey men or little green men?
Oh, okay, yes, no, you're right. I think they are called greys, the Area 51s. I don't know where the green must have come from somewhere else then.
I think a similar time, I think. But that's our two main ones, isn't it?
Yeah. Little grey men, little green men. Fun fact, the Incredible Hulk used to be grey. I think it's...
Oh.
I don't know what inspired them to change it, but it might be a similar sort of thing. Mm. It might just be because... Frankenstein as well, actually. I think it might be a black and white sort of... on cinema screens, going from black and white to Technicolor, because often they would paint their faces green to get the best form of that coming out.
Or it's like the Addams Family set was actually lots of shades of red and pink.
Oh, wow.
Because red also shows up really well.
That's going to change a lot.
Filming in black and white. But definitely, I think it starts out with this one vision from one set of things, and then we're slowly sort of diversifying our views of what aliens might be, but there is still always going to be this trope of little green men.
In effect, any time you need a budget sci-fi series, the aliens are always going to look like humans. I don't know if you've been watching Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
I haven't, but I know of it.
I think they've had a budget cut recently. And so as a result, their aliens have gone from looking sort of... I mean, they used to be able to use the Chitarian stuff from Avengers, but now they've had to use sort of humanoid-looking robots... And then they've just gone for, well, actually, these are just humans, but with a whatever face paint of the week, effectively.
Yeah.
So they've
sort of old school Doctor Who aliens as well. So it's just someone in a costume.
Although this is one of the things I quite like about Doctor Who is when it was off air, sort of on the 40th anniversary of it, there's a company called Big Finish that sort of got the Doctor Who license when it wasn't on TV anymore. And they produced lots of audio dramas. And for the 40th anniversary, they produced a thing called The Sir Graeus, which was their sort of big crossover thing where all of the doctors they had a license for sort of came together to do a voice.
Yeah.
So Peter Davison, Colin Baker, Sylvester McCoy, and Paul McGann.
Yeah.
And one of the main plot points in there was the question of why does everything in Doctor Who look human? And the answer is there's a big main Time Lord called Razzlon who is... Just the worst.
Yes, yeah.
And he hears that there's a plot for some alien species called the Divergence to overthrow him. So he introduces a virus that eliminates all forms of life that aren't sort of bipedal.
Oh.
And that's why you get an awful lot of aliens that sort of
stand
up and walk around, which is a I mean, the main
thing. That's a clever way of getting around it.
I mean, Big Finish largely exists just to fill in all of the various plot holes in Doctor Who, of which I admit there are many. For example, they have three different ways of how Atlantis sank. But yeah, no, so that's... It's one of those things that they sort of justify every now and again just to... But, you know, I don't mind the odd human-looking alien in a way.
Well, I suppose, I mean, that's the thing is, like, with tropes is that sometimes it can be annoying or cliched, but then sometimes it can be kind of comforting to sort of know how something's going to turn out. You know this is going to have a happy ending if... It's like watching certain genres, like if you watch a romance, you usually think it's going to have a happy ending.
Exactly, yeah. I think it's comforting to, exactly as you said, just for things to play out every so often, or just, I think it's sort of, you know, if there's ever a distressing period in the thing, it's nice to know, actually, I know this is going to end well. If you don't know it's going to end well, that is a very different rom-com.
Yes. In a way. Yes. Well, it kind of makes me think of... I was watching John Wick recently.
Oh, yes.
And it's not very early on, so I don't think this is really a spoiler, but the dog dies.
Yeah.
And I was very upset. Mm. But also, I was watching it with my partner. I turned to him and I said, does this dog die? Because this film seems very gritty. And he went, And I went, it does, doesn't it? Oh, no. But there's a whole website called Does the Dog Die? And you can check ahead of time if the dog dies. And I think that can be really good as well. Like, just, you know... Is this sort of film going in the direction I think it's going? Mm. And again, I think sometimes, yeah, having sort of little tropes and things is a shorthand to understand what's going to go on with that.
Yes, the death of that dog is very much the rock on which John Wick has built his church, in a way.
Well, we were saying maybe next time he's got a new dog, perhaps this time he gets two extra dogs for when he goes into John Wick 3.
I sort of want, like, in Jurassic World, they sort of sold us in on the image of Chris Pratt on a motorbike with various raptors. I sort of want John Wick, but with wolves.
Yes.
Just sort of attack wolves.
He has a whole kennel's worth of dogs running with him. I mean, he stole that dog at the end, so I'm not sure how it's going to turn out. I haven't seen John Wick 2 yet, but I'm excited to.
I don't think they do anything like sort of the Taken franchise, which has just sort of been, my daughter's taken, my wife is taken, I flash back to earlier in my life when this other person was taken. It's sort of a... I think that...
Yeah, I mean, some movie franchises in themselves are a trope, so Taken is just... Taken has very simple premise, and it sticks to it, and it does well.
Mm. Yeah, there are absolutely sort of various sequels that just go, what if we did the same thing, but with slightly different ways around it, or often with the Disney video sequels, which are, what if we do the same plot, but with the children of the characters in the first one?
What if this time the princess is cold? Frozen, yay! What if this time the princess is Scottish? Brave, great. No, obviously they do have slightly different storylines, but the princess theme holds out throughout them, which is usually, I'm going to be a strong, independent woman and choose my own destiny.
This is something I've noticed recently about Disney films, and I think it's... I'm realising I'm probably going to plagiarise a Lindsay Ellis video here, but Disney is very quickly becoming aware of its own tropes and is sort of utilising them as a way of saying, look, we know you think this way about us, but we're better than that, we promise. And so as a result, you get things where, instead of Disney actually improving its sort of processes and not being a huge monopolising billionaire sort of cult that, you know, abuses its workforce quite a lot.
Now it's just stuff the same thing, but it's aware of it.
Yeah, it's the same thing, but it goes, hey, maybe we shouldn't marry this woman off to someone they just met and instead have them form a relationship with someone that they just met, but they only get married later on.
Yeah,
and it's
they wait 2 weeks rather than 1 week.
And in Moana, they, you know, they have all of the songs and so on, but they also have a bit where Dwayne Johnson says, ooh, I hope you don't break into song.
Yeah.
Because that would make this a cliche film, despite the fact that the very first thing he did was sing a song. It's... Yeah.
Or like in Frozen, I think Kristoff says to Anna at some point, like, you've only just met this guy, like, why are you marrying him? But she still wants to, and the story is still set up in that way. So, how aware they actually are of... They're sort of highlighting the trope, but they're not actually fixing it.
It's quite a sort of... A thing that's become a thing since Deadpool, where sort of, you know, they want to have their cake and eat it too. And sort of, in a way, I always think the meta-ness is their way of effectively wanting to control their own critical response, in a way. They want to still do the problematic thing, but if they comment on it enough, you know, they can get away with it.
I think we're coming towards the end of our time, so we'll wrap up now. But yeah, I think there's so many tropes out there, some of them good, some of them bad. We've discussed a few of them today. I'm sure we'll come back to some more in detail.
I don't think it's possible to do a thing without tropes, because in a way it's like saying make a tree without wood.
Yeah.
Tropes are inherently a part of it.
Well, I think
it's just...
there was someone said there's only about 15 plots in the whole world.
Kurt Vonnegut, yeah.
Yeah, I think. And then there's also, you know, only so many sort of different variations of those things you can come up with. So there will always be cliches, there'll always be tropes, but some of them are better than others. And
I think that's why the importance of having new and more diverse voices. I think that's
exactly.
That's one of the great ways to end tropes.
To make new stereotypes. No. Great. Okay, with that we're going to draw to a close. We now have social media, so if you want to follow us, we're on Twitter and Instagram at nerdofmouthurn, and we'll be on same time next week.